Welcome to a Money Matters breaking news interview with Dr. Amish Adolja from Johns Hopkins University, infectious disease specialist on understanding the key statistic on the coronavirus. That's the mortality rate, how the virus spreads, what we should know, what should we expect in the coming months, and what did China do wrong, and what can we learn from them? Good morning. Welcome to Money Matters. Your host, Wes Moss. You know that we have been out front and trying to get real perspective on coronavirus because right now the media is very much in what I consider a panic, and it's impacting markets. It's impacting economics. It's impacting I talk to business leaders around Atlanta and the Southeast, and I keep hearing we're canceling trips, we're canceling travel. And I say, well, are you doing that because of medical reasons? And the answer is typically, well, we're just doing it because everybody else is doing it. And then we get this self-fulfilling prophecy that is, hey, well, if everybody else is slowing down, we better slow down too. And we create this kind of this negative death spiral that is predicated on, and this is why I wanted to bring, I've looked high and low, and here we are in Atlanta, which is, we've got lots of contacts at the CDC and former CDC and epidemiology, which they've been great resources. But I think that one of the best resources that I've seen is Dr. Adolja from Johns Hopkins University Center for Health Security. His work focuses on emerging infectious disease and pandemic preparedness and biosecurity. So I don't know of anybody else with more credibility that we could possibly find on Money Matters to give us really real perspective on this. Well, let's go just right out of the gate. So I'm a dad of four younger boys. My oldest is 13 all the way down to a four-year-old. So I think of this as a parent, like a lot of folks, and obviously that have children, you're thinking of this from a health perspective. But then from an investment perspective and a market and an economic perspective, and I've been an economic market investment strategist for now more than 20 years, to me, my bottom line statistic on, which is just the all-important number to get to, the crux of this entire outbreak, if you will, not just the outbreak health, but for the world, is the, and I think it's the difference between this pandemic where we have an economic shutdown versus a not an economic shutdown and somewhat business as usual. And that is, I call this the king of all statistics right now, and that's the mortality rate. My doctor calls it the kill rate of the coronavirus. And that is right now that the World Health Organization is, the headline number right now is 3.4%, which is a really scary big number. And I've read your research that suggests that it is not going to be nearly that high. And that's, I think, the first important point I wanted to discuss.
Sure. So what we know about during the early days of an outbreak is you often get something called a severity bias. The data that comes to light first, the cases you see, are often hospitalized, sicker patients. And if you are focused on them, you're going to get a totally different picture than if you're out in the community looking for mild cases with runny noses, with maybe minimal symptoms. And the testing often skews towards the sickest because we want to diagnose those people first because they're the ones that are most at risk of having a complication. And you get a sample that has that kind of a skew. So when you look at the data, the WHO overall data, you do see a mortality rate of that in the 3% range. However, you have to remember that our testing is very incomplete and many places are not doing extensive testing. And there is some controversy over that. The WHO has pushed back on this criticism, but I do believe if you look, for example, at the data from South Korea, where they've done extensive testing, they actually have drive-through testing centers in South Korea, the mortality rate has dropped below 1% to about 0.6%. So I do think we're going to see the mortality rate drop to below 1%. How low, I don't know quite yet until we get our diagnostic testing scaled up, but I do think that we have to interpret those numbers with some caution, despite the WHO publishing.
Okay, well, I'll just jump right to that. So South Korea, again, the latest numbers I have are that they've tested around 160,000 people. They have 6,300 cases, and they've got right now it's still in the low 40s on the actual people have died, which to your point is around a 6.6, you know, around a 0.6 mortality rate, which is a lot different than the World Health Organization is saying. Why is there such a disconnect there? Why do they keep saying 3.4%? Doesn't that seem as though, and maybe is it just because they want to over-prepare people and they're okay to over-scare people in the early goings here and then have people realize eventually that this is not effectively Ebola that's killing 3 to 5, 10% of people?
We have to use the numbers that we've got. So I don't fault the WHO for using that number. I sort of do have a little bit of a qualm with them over not caveating that number. That is the number when you look at the number of deaths and the number of cases. But there is a big limitation of testing, and not every country is doing robust testing, so you're getting that skewed sample. So that number is a real number, meaning that that's what's reported. But the fact is we don't have the proper denominator. When you calculate a ratio like that, you have to have an accurate numerator and an accurate denominator. I do not believe that the denominator is as accurate, and I think we'll see more of that as testing increases. And the WHO has pushed back on us for saying this and saying that they didn't see many mild cases when they were in China, which is the bulk of the cases of the world. But I wonder what exactly they saw, and I'm just a little curious to know how there can be not mild cases in China, but there's mild cases everywhere else that we look.
Is South Korea, the 158,000 plus people that are tested, the 6,300 people that are infected, the 42 or so deaths, is that a big enough sample set, by the way, that you would say that that's a big enough number to really draw conclusions from?
I think it's big enough that this gives weight to the hypothesis that this is a lower mortality rate. It's not ironclad. Things can change, but it kind of fits with what we know about coronaviruses in general. Remember, this isn't the only coronavirus. There are six other human coronaviruses, and we have a lot of information about the spectrum of illness of respiratory viruses. We're seeing cases outside China. We're hearing about cases in the United States and how so many of them are mild and how many are getting picked up in flu surveillance type of studies. So I do think that even though the sample size, we want it to be bigger in South Korea, we wish it was bigger because it would give us more confidence. I think it's enough to give us a hypothesis that has evidence behind it. So it's not something that's kind of an arbitrary assertion that we're just basing this on small numbers and making kind of a hasty generalization. I think there is enough there. And as South Korea tests more, we will get more confidence in that number. And hopefully other countries will come online doing that type of testing as well.
So if South Korea is sub 1%, in the long run, where do you think this thing could potentially be once we look back a year? Could it be at as low as the regular flu? Could it be 0.1 or 0.2, 0.3, 0.5? Could it get that low?
I think it's likely to be higher than the seasonal flu, maybe around 0.5%. But again, that's a lot of speculation on my part because we don't have full data on testing. And I'm kind of eyeballing it, thinking about where I think it might fall. But I think it's looking that it likely will be possibly more severe than seasonal influenza in terms of its death rate, but not near the 3% that we're hearing about now. That's why the South Korea data is better, because it's actually testing a general population.
And how's their healthcare system, Amish? How is their healthcare system in South Korea? Is it similar to the United States healthcare system?
Somewhat in terms of the technology and the methodology for dealing with severe illness, yes. And remember that South Korea just a couple of years ago had a large coronavirus outbreak with the Middle East Respiratory Syndrome there that infected quite a few people and killed several dozen. I can't remember the exact numbers, but it killed that virus has a mortality rate of about 30%. And they had a large outbreak there with multiple people infected and really had a lot of lessons learned from that outbreak with Middle East Respiratory Syndrome that's informed their approach to the new coronavirus.
And that's maybe why they're so quick to be able to really get this thing testing this. I didn't hear this, but drive-through testing, that's pretty amazing. So they're very ready for this.
Yes, I think that they really were hit hard by the Middle East Respiratory Syndrome, one of the biggest outbreak outside of the Arabian Peninsula for that coronavirus. So I do think that they became very adept at dealing with an infectious disease emergency and really sprung into action pretty quick based on their geographic location as well as the experience with MERS.
But let's talk about the spread. I think I've read your research that it could be 20% or higher. So you think this thing is already out there and it's been percolating, and much like the influenza, this thing really could spread to a huge part of the population.
Yeah, I do think that you're going to see a high attack rate. Remember, this virus spreads efficiently in communities, and we don't have population immunity to it. So with the H1N1 pandemic in 2009, about 20% of the population was infected. So I think that's kind of the lower bound in my mind for what this virus will do, because the H1N1, there were certain people that were born between 1918 and 1957 that had some protection. So that brought down the attack rate. But we don't have that with this coronavirus. So I do think you're going to see an attack rate that goes above 20% and maybe into the 40-50% range.
Got it. The question then goes right back to vaccine and then therapeutics. I mean, I think we've heard over and over that they're already testing vaccines. It should take about a year. Would you agree with that?
Yes. I think we've been rapid to get vaccines into clinical trials, but getting something into a clinical trial is not the same thing as mass producing it and getting all this efficacy and safety data. So I do think 12 to 18 months is when we will start see a vaccine. So the public needs to know that this first wave of this coronavirus is going to be handled without a vaccine.
How about therapeutics? And when do you get a Onefluza or a Tamiflu-like therapeutic for this?
We are trying to repurpose some antivirals that had been made for other purposes. So, for example, there is a drug called Remdesivir, which is made by Gilead, that's being repurposed from Ebola to this, and it's already in clinical trials. It's already been given to patients. So there is some hope with that drug. There's an anti-malarial drug that's already FDA approved that has activity against this virus that people are trying to use. There are other experimental compounds. So I do think we may get a drug treatment for this in the next month. We get some data probably the next month for this. And it will be important to remember that you have to figure out not just that something works, but who are the best candidates to get this? Is it really going to only benefit sick patients, hospitalized patients, those with risk factors? It may not be for everybody because, like I said, the vast, vast majority of these cases are mild and don't even require hospitalization. So they may not necessarily need an antiviral, but maybe our sicker ones that are in the hospital will.
If you're just joining us, this is Dr. Amish Adalja, Johns Hopkins University Center for Health Security, really the leading voice on some sanity around the coronavirus and the mortality rate, which is, I think, the most important statistic about this. But here we are talking about therapeutics. When you get, Dr. Adalja, when you get, let's say, the 30, 40, 50,000 people that have already recovered from this, does the medical community, are they able to take those folks and utilize any sort of serum because they were over that? Is that not something that can happen? Their current immunity, people that have already gotten it, does that help at all?
Yes, this is an active area of investigation. And in China, they are using what we call convalescent plasma from individuals who have recovered. They then transfuse that plasma into people who are sick. And there is active study going on. This should be studied in a randomized controlled trial. And we've done this type of work with Ebola, for example, and other infections, even during H1N1 and with SARS, they gave convalescent plasma with mixed results. I think this is something that is important to understand. And while the convalescent plasma itself might not work, looking at the antibodies of people who recovered may help find new treatments, because those antibodies can then be synthetically made. And we've seen that type of approach used for Ebola very successfully. So looking at the blood of survivors is really important, is a really important avenue of research, and hopefully will lead to therapeutics.
Hang tight. We'll be right back with Dr. Amish Adalja. Welcome back to a Money Matters breaking news interview with Dr. Amish Adalja from Johns Hopkins University infectious disease specialist on understanding the coronavirus. And are we better, faster, smarter about this, Dr. Adalja, than we've been? I mean, how much better are we than 10 years ago with H1N1? How good are we now when it comes to the speed of figuring these things out?
Technology has rapidly advanced between 2009 and 2020. We really had this virus sequenced very quickly. We had test kits made very quickly. There's been botched rollouts of those test kits. But I do think that we have gotten better at characterizing infectious disease threats and making therapeutics much quicker. The vaccine that's already been delivered for clinical trials at the NIH went into clinical trials basically at record speed. So there are a lot of new technologies that have just really come to fruition in the last several years that are being harnessed to fight this outbreak. So we're getting better at doing it from a technological perspective.
Now that Vice President Pence said we've got 1.5 million test kits now in the U.S., we're going to deploy them. So over the next couple of weeks, how quickly do you see, and this is what makes me a little bit nervous, because again, the miscommunication, the conventional wisdom around this, of course, now that we're going to test 1 million people, of course, I would think the number of people that test positive for this is going to skyrocket. Doesn't mean more people are going to die. It just means we're finding more people that already have it. Do you think it's going to, starting in the next couple of weeks, it's going to go just through the roof?
I do believe we're going to see more and more positive cases all over the United States, many of which have no connection to China or South Korea or Italy or Iran. We're going to see what we call community-based spread. And that may panic the public at first, but I think it's a good thing because then we're going to get an understanding that this is not a containable virus, that people have to get ready, and we'll get a better handle on the case fatality ratio as we can see how many mild cases there are. So this will sort of demystify the virus for a lot of people when they see that this isn't something that you need to avoid people from certain countries or do enact travel bans from certain countries, that this is no longer a travel-related illness, and it is one that's endemic in the United States.
Got it.
And many other countries of the world.
Would you be traveling? Are you, I've talked to CDC about this, and they're still very much saying, go to the website and look at the typical precautions, which are wash your hands. Is this a droplet spread versus an airborne? We're going to run to a quick break. When we come back, we're going to have that answer. I need a dollar, 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 that's what I need. Welcome back to a Money Matters breaking news interview with Dr. Amish Adolja from Johns Hopkins University. Let's get back to this question about how this spreads, whether it's droplets or airborne. Let's say you never touched your face. If you, for some reason, you were really good at not doing that, even though we're supposedly touch our faces 26 times an hour. Is there, if you never touch your face and you really wash your hands, you know, let's say 10 times a day, how different is that in your ability to not catch something like this versus if it was airborne, if it is airborne?
So I do think that the primary mode of transmission is droplets. So those are the particles of saliva and liquid that come out of your mouth and your nose when you cough and sneeze. And they travel about 6 feet before gravity affects them and they fall to the ground. There may be a small amount of airborne transmission, particularly in hospitalized settings when people are getting medical procedures such as bronchoscopy or intubation or getting a drug aerosol treatment, which could aerosolize the drug. So when you're out in the community, it's likely droplet transmission is the main thrust of transmission. In a hospital setting, you may get some airborne transmission, and there's also extraordinary circumstances where you might get airborne transmission. But this really is a droplet precaution type of thing, and that makes it easier to control than an airborne virus like measles, for example. So if you do wash your hands a lot, if you don't touch your face, and you can avoid people coughing and sneezing on you, you may decrease your risk of contracting this.
That makes sense. Do you travel now? Are you totally fine to continue to travel through the middle of this?
Yeah, I just got off a plane about an hour ago.
Within the United States, or what about internationally?
I traveled internationally about 2 weeks ago, but today I just traveled domestically. I think the issue is that I'm not afraid of getting the virus internationally. I can get that virus in the United States if I want to get it. The issue is if you travel internationally, that you might run into logistical problems with quarantines and bad government policies by governments around the world that might get you stuck somewhere. And I think that's what you have to keep in mind when you travel internationally. Obviously, there are CDC travel warnings to several countries, such as South Korea, to China, to Italy, to Iran, and obviously Iran, which most U.S. citizens don't travel to anyway. So you have to really think. You really have to think about if you're going to leave the country, how easy it will be for you to get back. Because, for example, if you go to Italy, they're going to make you self-quarantine yourself for 14 days when you come back. And I probably wouldn't want to do that and disrupt my life that way. So you have to think about that, not necessarily the virus. You can get that in any town probably soon in the United States.
Why is it? It seems to me as though the Chinese government has basically said, hey, everybody go get back to work. And China is getting almost fully back to work almost as we speak. Now, it's taken some time. There's been a big gap in people going back to work. Obviously, these quarantines and semi-quarantines. Do you read anything into the Chinese government saying, hey, just get everybody back to work?
I think that's probably a better approach than what they did before with locking down 60 million people, suppressing free speech, using armed guards to prevent people from moving, pulling people out of their houses and putting them in gymnasiums. I think that authoritarian approach was the wrong thing to do. I do think that because this is an efficiently spread respiratory virus that's been going on since at least November, you have to think that this is not something that's containable. And the longer we stick on this containment mentality, the more disruption this virus is going to cause. Because when you shut down parts of an economy, when you lock people away like they were doing, you're not going to really be able to get a handle on, you're going to make things paradoxically worse. Logistically, it's much harder to get things into that area. You're going to panic the population, inundate the hospitals. And that's what you saw happen in Hubei province. I do think a better approach would have been this is something that we're going to have to deal with. If you are sick, if you have symptoms, we can self-isolate you in your house. We can connect those who need to be hospitalized to be hospitalized, and we need to be able to go on with our lives the way we did during 2009 H1N1. We did not see this type of approach being taken then, and I think that's an important lesson to draw, is that China kind of took some drastic measures and then set the tone for the rest of the world, and we're kind of still paying for that because now that's being held up as an example by the WHO and other organizations, and I think it's a bad example. We may see, I think that getting factories back open is really important for the economy and for the fact that this isn't going to go away. So you have to open them sometime. This is going to become an endemic virus in humans. So you can't lock down the world forever.
And then, but even though it's endemic, if we have a vaccine, will the vaccine operate a lot like kind of like the flu, or it doesn't prohibit you from getting it, but it will help a lot of people and then maybe make it a little less bad if you get it?
We don't know yet because we obviously don't have vaccine. We don't have clinical trial data for the vaccine. But ideally, we want a vaccine that provides what we call sterilizing immunity, like the measles vaccine, where it completely makes you really impervious to infection under most circumstances. That's what we really want to have. But we don't quite know where that will fall because we don't have any human coronavirus vaccines to go off of. So we don't know. The flu vaccine is another show for you to do on understanding the nuances of that vaccine. But hopefully we'll have something that's better than the flu vaccine. It's more like the measles vaccine.
Summer. Is there any validity to these viruses don't live as well if it's hot? I've heard that that's not true. Or is it just because we discongregate or we're just not as close in the summer versus the winter?
It's a combination of factors. We do know that the other four seasonal coronaviruses do exhibit seasonality with peaks in the winter and spring. And that peak of respiratory viruses may have to do, like you said, with the way we congregate and the way we behave in colder months and temperate climates. But it also may have to do with the humidity and the air temperature, the temperature in our nose, which can favor or disfavor transmission. So I do suspect we may see some tapering off in the northern hemisphere as we enter summer. But remember that the southern hemisphere will then be entering winter. So you may see acceleration of transmission in the southern hemisphere. And remember, the tropics usually don't have seasonality to their respiratory viruses.
Because they're always warm. Let's go to two more quick questions, age and then zoonosis. Age. There's been, and I'm following this on the World Healthometer, and I'm looking at all the different cases and countries and mortality rates and people that are sick. There's a clear delineation. It looks a lot like the flu. The mortality rate is ultra low for those who are younger, and then it climbs pretty significantly at age 60, at age 70, and certainly at age 80. Can you at least... And I think that might be one of the disconnects. When I talk to CDC, they say it's detrimental to keep using this one big number, 3%, because really it's discounting how rough it is for the older population, and it's overestimating the impact on the younger generations.
Yes, that's definitely true. That when we use an average number, whatever it might be, you're not really getting the nuance of it. And it's clear that when you advance in age, each advancing decade confers a higher mortality rate with this virus, and the younger you are, the less likely you are to die. So, and that's something that we see with many respiratory viruses, most notably influenza, where the elderly are disproportionately affected, and that's what it looks like with this virus as well. The elderly and those with other medical conditions.
And the almost zero fatalities under the age of 10, isn't that a little shocking?
I think it makes sense because most of the respiratory viruses tend to be less, they tend to be milder. There's many respiratory viruses that are milder, many diseases that are milder in children than in adults. So think of chickenpox, for example. And it may be that children are protected from severe disease because maybe their immune systems are not as mature, so they don't have as robust of an immune response, which can sometimes be responsible for the severity of the symptoms that you get. And it may also be the fact that, remember, there are four other coronaviruses and children get lots of colds. And there may be some cross immunity because they're so much more heavily exposed to coronaviruses in their daily life than adults are.
Let's go to zoonosis. And I think isn't this one of your specialties? I watched a talk you did in a classroom and you were talking about basically spreading from animals to humans. And just the thought that there's so many of these diseases have emanated from China and Asia. How do they, I'll admit I've never been to one of these markets. I've never been to China. Do they literally have a food market with live animals? Like, can you just paint a quick picture of what that looks like if someone's never been there?
So some of the live markets will have animals that you can pick out that you want to be slaughtered for your own consumption later at home. So people have a desire for very fresh food there. Some people may have a lack of, maybe historically had a lack of refrigeration, so they wanted to have things fresh. So they go and they pick out what they want. So those live markets house different animals of different species all together, and they're slaughtering them, and there's body fluids mixing. There's things getting kind of thrown around there. And that's an ample opportunity for pathogens that might be in other animals to jump into humans. So that's why animal markets were the focus of this initial outbreak. We don't know which animal did this jump from. We know that all coronaviruses circulate in bats. So it came from bats and it has an intermediate animal and then to humans. And the latest speculation has been on the pangolin, but it hasn't really been confirmed. But we know, for example, that SARS went from bats to palm civet cats and MERS went from bats to camels.
The pangolin, that's how you pronounce that? It's like a little scaly animal?
Correct. But that's not been fully vetted. That's just one hypothesis that's out there. I don't know that it's been debunked yet or confirmed.
And one more question here. Let's end back on the fatality rate, because, again, I think that is the king statistic here between economic shutdown and business as usual, plus I'm going to wash my hands. So is it something like 80% of cases? This is probably speculation. But is it 80% of cases don't have or don't show symptoms? What is that statistic?
It's about 80% of the data show that most cases are mild. 80% are mild and 20% are more severe. And even that's a skewed sample. It's probably higher than 80%. But that just means that 80% of people have symptoms that are really indistinguishable from the common cold or a severe common cold.
We're using South Korea as a really good example of where this is probably headed. We don't know for sure, obviously. The mortality rate there is well sub 1% already. It's at 0.65, if I'm doing the math correctly. Where do you think mortality rate is now and will likely end up in the next 6 months to a year?
I think mortality rates are going to go down as we increase our testing. And I think that they will be below 1%. And I think right now I'm looking at maybe it's 0.5%, and that is a significant mortality. It might not sound like a very big number, but it is much higher than seasonal influenza. And I think it's important to remember, even with the low mortality rate, this is going to be disruptive because you're going to have a lot of sick people coming into the hospital, clogging up hospitals, clogging up ICU. So we're going to have a disruptive time with this virus, but I don't think it's going to be cataclysmic.
Do you think it makes sense? I mean, the CDC still is somewhat emphatic on this discongregation. Do you think that they're going to cancel schools and have kids learn from home? I know that this is nothing to do with medicine, but do you think it'll get to the point where most schools in the U.S. are like, hey, stay home, kids?
I think that's going to vary from school district to school district, and it's going to be dependent upon what the intensity of spread is. School closures are a complex decision. It has to involve, you know, how much intensity of spread is going on in your community, how early you do it, because if you've got a lot of community spread already, they're not going to get any impact. And then you have to think about what will happen to the kids. Where will they go when they're not at school? Are they going to congregate somewhere else? Are they going? Who's going to take care of them? Who's going to feed them? Because some kids get their meals at school. What are you going to do with the parents that now have to take off of work? And we don't even know what the role of kids are in transmission for coronavirus. We know they amplify influenza, but do they amplify coronavirus the same way? So that's an important question to answer before we do that. But we're going to see it happen regardless, because it's an easy political thing for school boards to do.
You've tuned into a Money Matters breaking news interview about the coronavirus. Hang tight, more straight ahead. You've tuned into a Money Matters breaking news interview with Dr. Amish Adolja. When do you think we get, let's say we're only at 50% clarity today, which creates still all of this. There's a ton of panic around this still. In the medical community, at what point, how many weeks or months or years does it take, do you think, for people to kind of wake up to the reality and for most of the world to kind of get what I would consider a solid understanding of this?
I think it's going to be probably within months to get this, because it's going to be a function of how quickly we can test and get a picture of what's going on, how much longer it will take to get good clinical data out of different countries and their clinical experiences, and how much time it will take to get clinical trial data from the antivirals to see how well they work. So I think that in a couple of months, we'll probably have a better idea on this. But every day, thing is, you know, a huge addition of knowledge kind of gets dumped out there on this virus. So, but I do think to really be able to completely risk stratify it, I think you're going to need probably about a month to really get things going. And it's really going to be a function of testing. I think that's the most important thing.
Dr. Amish Adolja, Johns Hopkins University infectious disease specialist and now guest of Money Matters. I know you've been all over the media, man. I think that what you're doing is super important, because there's still a really big disconnect. I'll tell you, this is what in my 20 plus years of doing this, I think where we are today is one of the largest disconnects between the conventional wisdom and the reality of the situation that I have seen, again, in 20 years. So I think you're on the forefront of really trying to explain it rationally, and I think that's really helpful. So important work. Please keep doing interviews for as many places as you have time to do, my friend. And thank you for all of your insight here on Money Matters.
Thanks for having me.
What an informative and important interview, and what great perspective on what's really happening in the world. I think the narrative on what's happening in the world with coronavirus is much worse than what we will find out it to be over the next, call it, coming weeks and coming months. And I think that's really important. And bringing this information to you today, I think this, the very crux of the hysteria is what we talked about today with Dr. Adolja. It's the actual mortality rate for COVID-19. And I think that rate itself is the critical line in the sand between people continuing commerce as usual or stopping commerce as usual. If we stop commerce as usual because the mortality rate is exaggerated, that'll mean we'll probably go into recession. If we go back to business as usual when we realize that the mortality rate is something well lower than 1%, call it 0.5%, which we learned today, which is very likely, or maybe even lower than that, then that means we won't go into recession because of this. And that's the critical distinction between the two. And I think that what we learned today is that there will be a time, and I suspect that will be relatively sooner than later, and I'm thinking weeks, maybe months, a month or two, but certainly not 6 months, that the public will wake up to the fact that this is not the end of global commerce as we know it. It's not the end of the world. Literally, the sun will come out tomorrow, as in the spring will be here soon, which things will get better here in the United States. Now the virus may go head down to the southern hemisphere and start to spread, but we will have some reprieve and relief when the weather warms up as well here in the northern hemisphere. You have tuned into Money Matters. Of course, you can always find me and the Money Matters team. We're trying to continue to stay way out in front of this topic because it's so important to seek to understand first is what we're trying to do because we're investors. And it matters. And it matters to understand what's happening in the economy, the world, and the stock market. If you want to find me and the Money Matters team, it's easy to do so. You can go to wesmoss.com, WESMOSS.com. You can email us. You can get in touch with a member of our team. If you've got a financial situation that's somewhat complex and you are saying, hey, I don't want to do this investing on my own completely anymore, and I want some help, that's exactly what our team at Capital Investment Advisors do. And we are, of course, happy to help. We're headquartered in Atlanta, offices also in Denver, in Tampa. And we'd love to hear from you, and we'd welcome that. So thank you so much for tuning in. I'd love for you to share this with your friends and your family. Again, we're trying to get real information out, understanding perspective of what's really happening relative to panic, which is so important to do. Have a wonderful rest of your day.